Millions of people voted for change. Voting for a party that committed to bringing train services back into public ownership, a service which would put passengers before profit.
At this time, it is our railways which are about to become the latest victim of the government's desire not for government oversight, but for state control.
This isn't just moving things on paper. This is about having the right leadership for the people and the right ability for things to come together.
What is Great British Railways? At this stage, we don't know.
Welcome to the last Rail News podcast for 2025. The Railways Bill is the big story at the moment, and the industry is calling for more details about how tomorrow's railway will work. But although the Future Act had its second reading on the 9th of December, there are still many uncertainties. Certainly, RMT General Secretary Eddie Dempsey would like to know what the implications are for his members.
What is Great British Railways? At this stage, we don't know, and nobody's been able so far to describe it to us beyond, you know, the very superficial stuff that anybody picking up a newspaper would be able to discern. What is the shape of it? How would it work? Who is going to be in charge and all of the rest? So that is of concern. So all of this seems to be to play for in the coming period, but is it going to be a single employer? How will it work? Who's going to be in charge? Who do we negotiate with? All of the rest of it, we've got no idea at this stage, and that's the biggest worry.
One problem, if it is a problem, that seemed to me was it's not at all clear what the relationship will be between the mayoral authorities like Mr. Burnham in Manchester and GBR as a whole. Again, doesn't that possibly have implications for RMT members?
Of course. And I've been speaking to Andy Burnham, I've been speaking to Steve Rotherham and others about how this will work. And look, we think that actually is quite important for some of those devolved authorities, no matter where they are, to have a stake in the design and construction of services locally. We would have a preference for it all to be under one umbrella, but with some devolved decision making. One thing that's extremely important with the railway is the role it plays in driving economic growth around the country, but it's absolutely vital for driving economic growth, particularly in places outside of London. And to have an integrated setup, you need to have the involvement of the devolved authorities so they can try to design their local integrated transport networks so they can bring timetables together across different modes of transport. In some cases, integrate fares, for example. So I know Andy Burnham is seeking an arrangement similar to TfL, where some of the, I suppose, the Manchester version of the metro area in London, people will be able to tap and pay as part of the B network, but services operated by Great British Railways. But there'd have to be some close links there to get the design of the local services right so that it all fits together. That again is another area where there's been hints and direction, but the clarity is not there yet. So there's a lot to be done, really, with GBR. I'm hopeful that in the new year we can crack on with some of that. We would like to get into discussions and start those deeper discussions with everybody involved sooner rather than later, so that we're not getting to the point of transition to GBR and getting to that point and realising that there are significant disagreements or problems that really we could have been working out many months, even years in advance.
There are a couple of issues, aren't there? One of them is outsourcing, and the other is the recent letting of a new concession to the private sector for London Overground. How are you dealing with that one?
Well, we're furious about it. It's crazy, in our opinion. You've got a Labour government with a legislative agenda to bring the railways into public ownership, and the benefits of doing that are integration, for a start. But also, there's a lot of money to be saved for the taxpayer by doing away with a lot of the profit leakage and commercial fees, management fees, profit making, and all of the rest of it, as well as using the purchasing power of something like GDR. So all of the logic of that makes absolute perfect sense. But then the decision to then contract out or continue to outsource major pieces of our infrastructure, like the London Overground, multi-million pound contract, to me it just beggars belief, because as we've seen with the train operating companies, that could be taken into public ownership tomorrow. There would be zero friction. But what we would be getting is that cold revenue that is instead leaving the network in the form of profit. It just seems mad to us to do it and completely out of step with what the national government is doing.
Imagine that at the moment listening to us is a girl or a boy of about 18. They've perhaps just done sixth form college and they're wondering what to do with their lives. Would you recommend them to work for the railway?
I absolutely would. And I've got to say, it's a very exciting time too. I'm trying every avenue possible to address a long-term workforce plan for Great British Railways and the railways in general for the next 30 years. We need people coming into the industry, and I'm a keen proponent of having a national rail apprenticeship to get school leavers in, help them become the future engineers and operators of our industry, give them good, stable careers for their lives where they can move around and get new experiences, and also a good entry grade for getting in those young people who don't necessarily have the school skills, but have got a part to play, and through skill progression, help develop those people too.
Eddie Dempsey, General Secretary of the RMT. One controversy concerns the role of the regulator. Great British Railways is set to make its own decisions about who has access to its network. ARUP director Stephen Sanders says it's easy to see why open access operators want to know more about how it will work.
I certainly get the concern that there is around ORL's current control, if you will, of access rights passing to GBR. But if GBR is going to integrate track and train to some degree, it does need to take some response for that. And with TOX disappearing and the remaining open access bodies from freight and passenger still being a significant, you know, minority, but a minority, it is a logical change. My reading of the proposals as they were made originally in February and from my review at the end of last week is ORL still has quite an important role to play as the appeals body, and its appeals role will extend, if I've interpreted what I've read correctly, not just to the open access environment, but it will also extend to mayoral authorities that don't feel their needs and wants have been properly considered, as well as potentially any other disputes that occur in the timetabling space. So yes, it is a different role. And it is a role that is different to today, but one I think that still leaves the ORR quite a bit of influence over this point. And I would expect after the creation of GBR and a number of attempts to establish case history, I imagine from the freight operators, the remaining passenger open access operators, and potentially other bodies as well who either are running their own operating companies or who feel their views are not being represented. So my take on it is, yes, there's a change and it is a different role, but the role still has influence and can still establish a history and a basis of challenge for the future.
There does appear to be encouraging news for freight operators, who of course are still open access, but a different kind of beast, because one of the duties of GBR will be to encourage the carriage of goods by rail. How much encouragement do you think is possible?
I think the encouragement could come from a number of areas. I think there's a real opportunity and a really important role here for GBR to think strategically about freight. I know some of that has occurred over the last 20 or 30 years, but freight, I think, has been neglected a little bit during privatization. The open access freight operators have been successful. They do have some ability to get support when they need support, although that is relatively limited. But I feel some of the strategic decisions about freight routing and other aspects have maybe got lost in the maelstrom of everything else that's gone on within the fragmented industry. And I would hope a guiding or directing mind of GBR properly laying out a freight strategy, working collaboratively with the freight operators who are ultimately the ones who are going to deliver it, creates that possibility. Obviously, there are schemes in play at the moment that the Department for Transport run that partly subsidise uneconomic container traffic to encourage that to switch to rail. And one would hope on the back of a more proactive role for GBR that maybe other forms of encouragement, financial or otherwise, could emerge.
ARUP Director Stefan Sanders. You're listening to Rail News. Great British Railways will also need to have a working relationship with the city regions. Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham is presently in the lead as the B network continues to be established. The first two national rail routes in Greater Manchester are set to become part of the B network in a year from now. Rob Johnson is an analyst at the think tank Centre for Cities, and he says talks have already started.
Manchester has been in discussion with Great British Railways, and these plans are part of that discussion where they want greater control over their rail networks. Now, there are provisions in the latest legislation to allow cities and mayors to have greater control over their rail networks. That said, there's still a lot to iron out on what Great British Railways' powers will be, you know, what its different functions are. And I think the missing one at the moment is a recognition that rail journeys within city regions play a different economic role, both locally and nationally, than other uses of the rail network, such as freight or intercity journeys. Now, from my perspective, given, you know, what we know about transport's role in the economic performance of big cities, there should be a recognition that actually these passenger services, such as the rail services that the B network is planning to take over, play this important role in Manchester's economy and therefore the national economy. So seeing that in what happens with Great British Rail, what is decided over its functions and powers over the next year or so, I'll be watching with keen interest, as I'm sure a lot of other people will be.
I suppose we have something of a parallel with Transport for London, which has been around for 25 years. And there, too, there is a certain amount of question marking going on about how much more heavy rail, that's national rail, should be taken over by Transport for London. That's not decided. The Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, has one view, and it would appear quite possibly that the government has a different view. Again, those conflicts have not been resolved. Can we learn from the Transport for London problem when it comes to Manchester?
Absolutely, we can. I think, you know, with Transport for London, you've got a demonstration in the UK of the powers of transport devolution that have happened over the past 25 years. So we can look at, for instance, TfL taking control of the overground network from national rail operators. In the same period, you've seen greater use of those services, greater reliability and integration within the current network. Now, I think that provides quite a powerful demonstration of the powers of transport, particularly rail devolution, and the fact that these services are part of the local transport network. And one of its main roles is to connect people to economic opportunities, often found in the city centres. And so Manchester is almost like the next step in that story. And of the secondary cities in the UK, it is the most advanced on its bringing transport under greater local powers. And so these next steps of the B network are the next phase of being able to demonstrate the powers of this transport devolution, both to other cities that want to follow suit, And you know, just more widely, so the next time potentially TfL wants to take over another suburban line, there's a little bit less tension between national government because their goals are aligned on, you know, growing the local economy and growing the national economy.
Well, just to leap ahead, if I may, and I'm fond of doing that, as regular listeners know, would there be a case, do you think, for Great British Railways to have what you could call an urban business unit? In other words, a unit specifically there to liaise with people like Mr. Burnham.
I think that, you know, a proposal like that sounds sensible. And from my understanding, there are sort of elements of GBR that are in deep discussion with the mayors. And I know they've been going on for a while now, even before announcements. You know, having a more explicit role for those things, having a more explicit goals that the fact that transport devolution in big cities is a good thing and plays a different economic role because of the way it can integrate with other modes of transport, such as buses, such as trams, to function as one system. I think having that recognition explicit in its, you know, policy documents and its guidance would just help the mayors understand that this is one of the government's priorities. They will be supportive in requests for greater rail devolution. And I think that element of alignment could be made more explicit. But, you know, that is not to say that these things aren't happening already, but they definitely should be and should be aligned on the economic goals that both parties want.
Rob Johnson of the think tank Centre for Cities. Our reporter Phil Marsh has been out and about, and his travels have taken him to Wendover, where they're working on HS2.
I'm at Wendover with HS2 on a specially arranged visit, and I'm with Martin Gamble. Martin, can you tell me what your role is here, please, and what have we just seen?
Hi, I'm Martin Gamble. I'm the Senior Project Manager for Section 2, which includes the Wendover Green Tunnel and a few other structures, small green viaduct and some overbridges and things. We've just been out to have a look at the Wendover Green Tunnel, which has been put in on a number of phases. It's a sort of double arch structure. So it sort of comprises a central wall, two side walls and two crown units. And each arch obviously takes either the train going down to London or up from London on the other side.
And to interrupt, there's a big gap in the middle of the tunnel that we've just visited. What's that about?
Yeah, so we've had to phase it because of the logistics in the whole area. We've had to phase it quite carefully. The big gap in the middle currently has Ellesmere Road going over the top of a temporary bridge. So at the moment we can't do that because there's about 1.4 metres cover between the top of the tunnel and the underside of the bridge. So that bit is going to be done using a separate methodology, using things called SPMTs.
That's the flatbed portable transporters.
That's right. So the big flatbed with loads of wheels on either side, and you can jack the wheels up and down to lift it up. And that will take the place of the crane in that particular location.
And how are you, that's where the centre of the kilometre-long tunnel, understand?
It's 1.4 kilometres. There's sort of 1.1 kilometres of normal tunnel, and about 300 metres, about 150 at each end of what they call a portal.
And, yes, we saw that when we went to Wendover Dean before, didn't we? Now, each of the nearly 3,000 segments are unique, aren't they?
There is some standardisation, not individually unique, but, there are generally sort of two types of units. One where you've got a lot of fill to go in over the top, or rows to go in over the top, so they're a bit thicker, and then some slightly thinner ones as well. But generally, you know, you can transpose, they're all the sort of same length and the same height and whatever, so you can transpose to some extent, but you do have to make sure that you get the right one in the right place at the right time, and we work on a sort of just-in-time delivery thing, so we've got to make sure that the lorries that leaving the the factory are the one of bringing the units that we can fit on that a particular day.
Phil Marsh, getting to grips with the details of one of HS2's many tunnels. The Railway 200 exhibition train, Inspiration, has also been seen at a number of stations, and while it was at Southampton Central a few days ago, Phil Marsh was also there.
I'm on the Railway 200 Inspiration exhibition train at Southampton, and I've managed to grab some time with Southwestern Railway's Phil Dominey. Phil, thanks for talking to Rail News about this. Can you tell me what your role is, please?
So my role is, I'm the Senior Regional Development Manager for Southwest Railway, but I've also had the pleasure and opportunity to take the lead for Railway 200 activities across our network.
How popular has Inspiration been here at Southampton? Because all I've seen is loads and loads of people turning up.
It's been extremely popular. We have had record numbers come through in the first 2 days, and we're sold out today. And as I think you've seen already this morning, we have had loads of excited school children coming through, which is fantastic.
So how many people do you reckon have visited at Southampton?
We've had over 1,500 already in the last 2 days, and say we're sold out today.
That's excellent. Now, yesterday when train was launched at Southampton, I gather there was a bit of a welcoming party.
We did a little official welcome to the train at Southampton. So we had the sea shanty singers who did a little musical note, and we had the Lord Mayor, and we were really well supported by Go Southampton in terms of laying on a little event and activity. Little thank you to our partners for everything they've done, and went down really well.
Southwestern Railway has been extremely active with Railway 200 events. Dare I say you might be the most active train operating company? Or,
in my personal opinion, I think we have been, but I don't know all the facts about others. But we've had 90 events so far this year, ranging from obviously the exhibition train you see here today and at Waterloo, to all the community events, working with my colleague Paula Aldridge, who's our community rail manager. We've got two murals here at Southampton, which is a homage to the train. So we have done a wide spectrum of activities right across our network.
And for people that have missing Inspiration, the Railway 200 exhibition train, where else can they see them on your network in the new year?
So she will be coming back to us in February half term. She'll be going to Swanage, and then onto the Watercress line, followed by Salisbury and then Kingston.
Phil Marsh at Southampton Central. During January, Inspiration will be at the Ribble Steam Railway in Preston, at Southport and Crewe stations, the East Lancashire Railway in Bury, and the stations at Upminster and Cambridge. You can find the full list at railway200.co.uk/inspiration. Finally, HSTs have run for the last time on scheduled services in England. Great Western Railway Castle Class sets made their final appearance between Plymouth and Penzance on the 13th of December. The first HSTs also ran on the Western Region 49 years ago, and from now on you will see them only on ScotRail services. The arrival of the HST in 1976 was celebrated by British Transport Films, which made its last production on 35mm film. Instead of a commentary, it featured a specially commissioned piece by David Gow called Overture 125. From everyone at Rail News, do have a Merry Christmas. We'll be back next year. Until then, goodbye.